from KQED. Hey there, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. And tonight we're bringing you a special broadcast to remember and honor San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. He died suddenly at the age of 59 on Friday night.
Adachi was a giant in the criminal justice community, the only elected public defender in the state, and really a tireless advocate for his clients who couldn't afford a defense attorney themselves.
Exactly. And we're going to come back and talk more about Jeff in a minute. But we want to begin by listening back to part of an interview we did with him just last month. Here it is.
I know you were born in Sacramento to working class parents, and your grandparents were actually interned during World War II. It sounds like that sort of part of your life, you know, your family's story did impact sort of how you've approached your job and why you went into this career. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I remember I was in third grade when I learned about it, and a teacher mentioned about this internment. And back then, no one talked about it. And so I got in a fight with this other kid who said, oh, your parents were in jail. And I got suspended. And my parents were like, well, why'd you get in trouble? I said, well, over this thing about them saying that you guys were in camps. I said, is that true? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, well, how did that happen? Did you commit a crime? No. The government put 120,000 people. And so I wanted to learn more about that. So I talked to people and studied about the internment. And it really, you know, made me upset that that had happened to them, because, you know, they were third generation Japanese Americans, so their like great grandparents were from Japan.
Do you think that sort of in some way set you on the course, the professional course that you ended up on?
Yeah, that, and you know, when I was in college, and I think I was 19, I got involved in a case of a San Francisco man who was wrongfully convicted of murder, was on death row, and I worked on his case not as a lawyer, but just as an activist for 4 years, raised money. Ultimately, the conviction was overturned. And Tony Serra, Stuart Hamlin, two local lawyers, retried the case. And I was in court when this man was found not guilty. And it was, you know, after that, I was hooked. I was like, I want to be a defender.
Well, you have, I think, a reputation of being a really strong advocate for your office and your clients. You're the only elected public defender in the state, which I think probably gives you a little bit more room to be that advocate. But, you know, you've also not been afraid to take unpopular positions. I mean, you beat sort of the hand-chosen successor in the public defender's office, who was, what, the niece of John Burton, former senator?
That's his daughter.
His daughter. I'm sorry.
Kimmick.
And then, you know, you've taken on pension issues in the city, like as a progressive, come after public unions on that. You've gone after the police department repeatedly when they've had problems with police misconduct. I don't know. I guess I don't know what my question is, really.
Well, some people kind of revel in that adversarial. Is it do you get sort of energy and get a charge out of that? And I mean, obviously, you're not afraid to break some eggs.
Well, you know, it's not always fun to take unpopular positions, and I've learned that the hard way many times. But I think that as a public defender, one thing that you learn early on is that you can't be afraid to stand up, even if it's unpopular. I remember one of the first felony trials I tried, the judge brought me up to the bench and said, you're a potted plant. Your job is to get your client to plead guilty. And I was just like, whoa. And, you know, we ultimately tried that case and I won it. And that was great. But the next client who was tried in front of that judge got the maximum sentence. And so, you know, you see that kind of unfairness happening. You're not always going to win, you know, the battle, but you try to win the war.
Jeff, you know, I think there are a fair number of people who see what you, meaning defense attorneys generally, do, defending, quote unquote, bad guys and helping them, looking for ways to, you know, minimize their sentence or get them off. And I'm just wondering, like, what do people not understand about the role of a defense attorney, or in your case, the public defender?
Well, it often takes personal experience, because once they have a family member who's in trouble, then suddenly they get it. And, you know, the idea that, you know, we only represent guilty people is not true. You'd be surprised of how many cases where mistakes are made. And, you know, we just had a case this week where a person was found not guilty, and they were trying to go into their own apartment, and they were perceived, the man was African-American, he was perceived as, you know, being a burglar. And so these things happen, and suddenly a person is in jail, they're charged with a crime, they have a high bail set on their head, and, you know, what's going to happen? Who are you going to turn to? Right, Ghostbusters? No, you're going to turn to the public defender, because that's your only hope. And in this country, public defender defenders have been notoriously underfunded. That's one of the issues I would like to see Kamala Harris step up on. And because if you don't have a strong, well-funded public defender's office, if you have a public defender who's got 500 felony cases at a time, what kind of justice are you going to get? And so that's why I fought very hard to ensure that our office has the resources needed so we can investigate cases, file all the motions, give our clients the same representation they would get if they could afford to hire a lawyer.
You mentioned bail there, and you know, I mean, clearly you are a tireless advocate for your clients, but also I think, you know, maybe some people might see you as a little stubborn. Last year, you decided to walk away from the bail sort of deal that was happening in Sacramento, saying that the ultimate deal you felt was basically unfair. It gives a lot more power to judges to decide who will get out and who won't. I'm just curious, like, what in a situation like that, when it's a conversation over, you know, ending a system that people like you see as inherently unjust and maybe creating one that isn't perfect, like, do you feel at all like you made the perfect the enemy of the good there, or was it worth it to
walk away? Well, I still support bail reform and SB 10 right now. There's a
referendum.
It's on hold.
It's going to be on 2020.
Are you going to oppose the referendum?
That's my position is going to be that we need the bail reform that's in SB 10. However, we need to improve on that. And our office really sort of started this whole ball rolling in California with the Humphrey case. This was a case involving a man who had a $600,000 bail set, and we appealed it twice to the Court of Appeals. And lo and behold, the Court of Appeals said that bail is unjust. And so we're going to be litigating this case in front of the California Supreme Court. So that's going to determine a lot of parameters of the new law. But the reason I oppose the law is because it gave too much power to the judges by replacing the bail system with something called preventive detention, which essentially allows judges to keep somebody in custody if they feel that they're a danger.
I wonder if you have... In the success of getting a defendant off for one reason or another, not guilty verdict, have you been worried about that person walking out of the courtroom because you thought, even though they got off, they could be a threat to public safety?
No. And, you know, people always ask that question. They say, well, what's it like to represent somebody that's guilty? Often you don't know.
I'm not saying they're guilty. I'm just saying, you know, I'm a little nervous. Maybe there's a technicality or something, and they really weren't guilty, you know, by the standards that are in front of you, but, you know, you may be worried about they committing another crime.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that could happen. I mean, you could represent somebody for driving with a suspended license, and they can go out and get in a car and kill somebody. Is that your fault that happened? It's our job to make sure that an individual's constitutional rights and their choice to fight their case or not fight their case is respected. And it's no different than if you're going in to buy something. You'd want to make sure that you got the best outcome possible. And a lot of cases are overcharged, so maybe you committed an assault, but lo and behold, you're charged with attempted murder. Oh, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to have a lawyer who's going to be able to litigate that case. And overcharging is one of the biggest problems that I see in our system, is that people are charged with a crime that the evidence does not support. And you'd be surprised how many cases are thrown out at a preliminary hearing because it's not supported by probable cause.
10 seconds. Do you think that with all the reforms we've seen and a lot of the sentencing changes in the legislature, that pendulum of power is swinging a little bit away from prosecutors?
Yeah, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime, but it's happening now, and it's going to be a big issue in this presidential debate, I think.
That was a portion of our January 24th interview with San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi, who died unexpectedly on Friday. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more on his life and work. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And we're back for this special edition of Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with Marisa Lagos, and we're remembering Jeff Adachi, San Francisco's public defender who died suddenly Friday at the age of 59.
Jeff was well known in San Francisco as a tenacious advocate for his office and the often indigent clients they represent. He was never afraid to take on the status quo or political power in San Francisco. And, you know, Scott, he actually started his career doing just that.
He did. You know, right out of law school, he was hired by the public defender in, I think, 1987. And he worked his way up in the office to chief attorney. And then the boss in the office, Jeff Brown, was appointed by former Governor Gray Davis to the California Public Utilities Commission. So there was an opening in the office. And the mayor at the time, Willie Brown, appoints John Burton's daughter, Kimiko Kim Burton.
And of course, John Burton is a legend in Democratic politics.
Of course. And everyone rallied around her, Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, and so on. But the first thing she did when she got into that office was fire Jeff Adachi, which a lot of people saw as getting rid of a potential political adversary. And so Jeff turned around.
And it was.
And she was right, but maybe not the right move because he did run against her in the following election, and he beat her 55-45%.
And, you know, I think we talked to Jeff about this a little bit, but he, you know, he and Kamala Harris, who was the district attorney for 8 years during his tenure, both really professionalized their respective offices. You know, they didn't have computers, which is like hard to believe that you had in one of the biggest cities in the state, so high profile. But he also just worked so hard as an advocate. And so for me, as someone who covered City Hall for many years, like one of the memories that will always stick out to me is around budget season when everyone's trying to negotiate for their piece of the pie. Often you'd see city department heads, other elected officials send over their deputies or somebody on their behalf to really advocate at the board, to lobby the mayor. Jeff would always be in City Hall himself. He was always impeccably dressed, very nice clothes, right? He did not let the fact that he was the public defender stop him from looking good. And he would literally personally stalk supervisors and just wait until they were done with a meeting so he could get in there and make his case. And it worked.
He was very hands-on. And, you know, yeah, it was effective. I think people, even if they disagreed with him, they respected him. They sensed his integrity and the fact that he was doing it not for his own aggrandizement, but for his clients, ultimately. And, you know, these are people oftentimes who are not the most sympathetic, you might say, who are charged with crimes. And public defenders' offices generally are not well-funded. They're not they're not expected even to be. They're expected to be overworked and kind of underpaid. But he wasn't really willing to accept that.
No, and you can see it because it is a nationally recognized office for the caliber of the lawyers he has there, for their loyalty to himself and their clients. You know, one of the cases or really the policies that I've covered in recent years that his office helped push was this change to the felony murder rule. So this is something that basically bars prosecutors from charging someone with a murder unless they actually committed the murder. So you couldn't have a getaway driver do it. This just passed last year. It's actually tied up in courts. One of his deputy public defenders, Jacques Wilson, took on his brother's felony murder case and was basically the face of this bill that was carried by Nancy Skinner. And it was really incredible to me because Jeff let this public defender take the time to do that. He actually gave him another assignment in the office so he could do this pro bono work. But it all just fit in with his larger view of justice and how they weren't just there to get off one individual client. They were there to try to change the system.
Right. And I think that's one reason you saw such loyalty for him. I mean, over the weekend, there was a very heartfelt press release that went out from the office with testimonials from various people in the public defender's office who had worked with him. And, you know, the theme was that he had really been a mentor to them, that someone who had had their back all the time was somebody that they could rely on, someone who really pushed them and encouraged them to do the best work that they could, oftentimes under very trying circumstances.
Well, and one of the reasons, quite frankly, that he had the space to do that is that he is the only public defender in the state. So he was not, you know, worried about if the Board of Supervisors or the mayor was going to take him out. And he actually talked to you about this on Forum not too long ago, or actually in 2014, I'm sorry. Here's how he sort of described it.
It's an interesting story because the first woman attorney in California, a woman named Clara Foltz, came up with the idea of a public defender's office in 1893. She spent 21 years pushing for it, and it finally passed in 1921, and San Francisco decided to make it an elected office. Everywhere else, the public defender is appointed. Now,
by the Board of Supervisors.
Right, and so I'm a very strong advocate of having elected public defenders, and Alaska elects its public defenders, as does Florida. And the reason why is because the district attorneys everywhere are elected, and the district attorney, you know, has that political power to do you know, what he or she wants to do independent of the Board of Supervisors or the mayor or anyone else. And I think it puts public defenders at a disadvantage when you're at will, when you have to answer to the Board of Supervisors rather than the electorate.
Oh, doesn't it also, though, being elected increase the chances that the DA or the public defender are going to act in a political manner or with political motivation because they are accountable to the voters?
That could happen, but in our jobs, what's different than, say, being a member of the Board of Supervisors is that our job is to provide legal representation to people. So that's not a political act. When you provide quality representation to folks, we represent over 20,000 people every year. We try over 250 jury trials a year. That's not a political act. What you're doing is essentially ensuring that people's rights are respected in the courts. Now, in terms of taking positions, I have a lot more freedom to be able to speak my mind. Why? Because I can't be fired except by the electorate. So it's important, I think, that public defenders have the independence, because we're the only agency, I like to say this, that is paid by the government to fight the government. We're the only ones that are guarding against police misconduct. And certainly in my office, I've done that where, you know, we've discovered a couple years ago that officers were stealing property and were violating people's constitutional rights. And we publicized that. In most places, that wouldn't happen. Why? Because the public defender might get fired.
Again, that's Jeff Adachi talking with me on Forum in 2014. Jeff died Friday of an apparent heart attack at the age of 59. And Marisa, in there, you see his sense of humor. You see his tenacity. You see what he had such a clear vision for what that office was, you know. And he wasn't afraid to mix it up with other elected officials. You mentioned Kamala Harris when she was the district attorney, George Gascon as well. And yet, although they were often adversarial in court, you can tell, you know, since Friday, they both put out messages that were very heartfelt, I think, and feeling, sensing their respect for him.
I think that's true really across the board in San Francisco. I mean, every single person who sort of interacted with him, or whether it was in an adversarial sort of position or on his side, I think has been really touched by this. I mean, and again, it's so shocking, you know, how sudden it was. He was in excellent shape. He, you know, I think we're all just sort of reeling from how sudden it seems.
Yeah, you know, we were actually talking earlier, Marisa, about that when we did interview Jeff just a few weeks ago, like 15 minutes before the show, he just sort of popped up in the newsroom. You know, it's like, how do people get, you know,
he's like a ninja.
We're supposed to have security, right? I said, Jeff, how did you get up here? He goes, and he's just, part of it is that he was here so many times.
Yeah.
He was so accessible to the media that he knew where he was going. He knew where we sat.
Well, and he had his own role in the media, right? I mean, he took on this other sort of career on top of his quote-unquote day job and all the advocacy work.
He's an avid filmmaker.
Yeah, he became a filmmaker.
He did. And he was also the subject of a PBS documentary called Presumed Guilty, which was really interesting because they had started that film before the election. I think they didn't really realize how interesting that election was going to become. But he did films on his own that had won awards in film festivals that spoke to his values, to Asian stereotypes in Hollywood, to other criminal justice issues related especially to Asian Americans. And, you know, these were things that really meant a lot to him. In fact, we have a little bit of a conversation we had with him talking about the film, about his defense of Michael Smith, who had been accused of assaulting BART police officers in San Francisco. Let's listen. What was it like? What were the challenges, and what was it like to be the director of a film that you are, you know, a co-star in, so to speak? It's a documentary, of course.
Yeah, well, I guess the Kardashians do it, so I'm not comparing myself to them. But
good.
It was different. As I mentioned, this was my fifth film. So other films that I have done, you know, have been more traditional documentaries where you're shooting an interview and you're showing something. Here, this is verite. So essentially, you have somebody who's following you around, Jim Choi, my co-director, and he's a great shooter, has made wonderful films. And he essentially, like in the scene from the riot that you just played from, that's me picking up Michael on the day of trial where he's supposed to testify.
Oakland, I think you picked him up.
In East Oakland. What happened was is that he lost his job because of this. He had a job at a youth center and he lost it. And so he was living in a van. And so I pick him up because his van's not working. He can't get to court. And, you know, it really shows something that people wouldn't normally see on Law and Order. You know, typically in a court case, you'll hear something about the case and the facts and the investigation, and then it goes through the trial and there's the argument. In this case, the judge would not allow us to film inside the court, but it actually turned out to be, I think, a good thing that we were forced to tell the story, you know, using body camera footage and other visual evidence and really show people what happens in the sort of underbelly of the criminal justice system. There's a scene, I'm not going to give it away, where you hear Michael express his frustration to the police officers on his arrest, and it's really one of the most powerful things I've ever seen.
That was Jeff Adachi, public defender in San Francisco, talking about his 2017 film Defender, a feature-length film really about the role of public defender. And, you know, he, as we said, was a filmmaker.
Kind of a Renaissance man.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think what you hear there, too, is how, again, Jeff didn't just see his role as running this office. The other really interesting thing is that he tried cases himself. And he would often take some of the more difficult cases. I don't know if you remember, Scott, but right when I moved to town, God, it must have been 2005 or 6, there was a case with a woman who basically went crazy and threw her 3 young kids in the bay.
So terrible,
and he defended her because, you know, he felt that everybody deserved that. She was clearly mentally ill. That was a really tough case. He, of course, didn't personally do it, but put two of his top attorneys on the defense of the man, the undocumented immigrant who was accused of killing Catherine Steinle on the pier, which became this national sort of debate over undocumented immigrants. But his office, you know, took those cases so seriously. And I think it just spoke to his belief that you need a fair system regardless of what someone's accused of.
Yeah. And a lot of times it means stepping up and defending people who the public or the media do not have sympathy for and who are not portrayed positively. But you take that on, you become their defender.
Right.
You know, because that's your job. That was his job. And he wasn't willing to just sort of, as he said in one of those other interviews that we played earlier, be a potted plant. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really, if he was going to defend you, he was going to try to get you off.
Yeah, absolutely. Which meant that he had a pretty complicated relationship with other people within the criminal justice system, you know, including police. He called out the police department, not just, you know, with the press conference, but with evidence over tampering with evidence, over illegal searches of single room occupancy hotels, over the fight club that deputies were running at the county jail at one point. I mean, really took on the, you know, a really entrenched and strong, powerful system.
And I think even as recently as last week, he was looking into allegations of inappropriate searches of female inmates in the county jail by sheriff's deputies. He also, of course, called out the police who had been caught sending those racist and homophobic texts.
Right.
And that, of course, you know, all these things. And we should say, not unrelated, push for pension reform and all of those things.
Which was taking on every entrenched
interest. That took on
interest.
But in particular, the police and the fire union.
Well, and I think to the point of holding people accountable, another sort of personal memory. Last year, myself and Evan Cernofsky from The Chronicle were asked to interview the district attorney, George Gascon, basically like his version of the State of the Union. So it was kind of to give people an update on how things were going. And this is at, you know, it's a public event. It's at the Hall of Justice. And Jeff Adachi saunters in and just sits down right in front and just looks at all three of us, and it did feel like he was holding us accountable. And you know, one of the cases that they have been sparring over was this bail case that he mentioned earlier, this Humphrey case, which actually could upend the entire bail system in California. But I want to let our listeners listen to him talking to you on forum again in 2017 about his relationship with the police and Gascon.
Well, you know, you would think it's pretty rough and tumble. From what you read, you know, in the newspaper, and often it's like the Police Officers Association, you know, versus something that I've said. But I get along with most of the officers. I see them in court. I've been around for 32 years, so, you know, I've been around a while. And, you know, I think most officers understand we have a job to do. And, you know, sometimes it becomes like a hand-to-hand battle in court. But in the end, you know, we all have to, you know, try to do the right thing. Now, I don't have a tolerance for officers who break the law or commit perjury, and I am very aggressive in terms of making that known and even holding press conferences to expose that. Because if you don't do that, then often it just gets buried, as at least that's been my experience.
The district attorney, George Gascon, I would imagine in a lot of places, the DA and the public defender, it's usually the DA who's very aligned with the police, and that the DA and the public defender are maybe more have a more tense kind of relationship. What's your relationship with San Francisco DA George Gascon, who has a, I would say, checkered relationship with the police department?
Yeah, Well, you know, from the very beginning, even when he was chief of police, because George Coscone was the chief of police in San Francisco and then became the DA, I always kid him. I said they should make a movie about that. But I've always had a good relationship with him. You know, we have each other's cell phone numbers. We call each other when there are issues. And we even meet once a month and with our staff, our senior management staff, to discuss issues. So our communication is very good. When we're in court, you know, the gloves come off and we fight, but we do our best to fight fair. And if there's a situation where I think a prosecutor is hiding evidence, I'll contact him and let him know. If there's a problem with one of my attorneys, he'll call me and let me know. So that's important. I think people want that.
And again, that was public defender Jeff Adachi talking about his relationship with District Attorney George Gascone. And I think that sums up kind of Jeff's approach to life, which is something I've always appreciated about him, which is, you know, it's not personal. He's going to do his job to the best of his ability, but he's not going to hold it against you when you're outside of a courtroom or somewhere else.
Right. And in that regard, you know, we had him on the show just 3 weeks ago, and it had been right after Kamala Harris announced that she was running for president. And, of course, as when she was DA, and again when she was attorney general, they clashed over things. He wanted her, for example, to do more investigations of some of these police shootings of young unarmed men of color. She was resisting that. And yet, you know, when the time came and she had announced, you know, he came on our show, and I think we both expected him to be somewhat critical of her, you know.
He was not.
And you could say, well, you know, he sort of like held his fire. But I think he genuinely had an appreciation for the role she played in the system as well. And the difficulty and the complexity of the decisions that either a public defender, an attorney general, or a DA has to make.
Yeah, and the fact that those are the roles that they've taken on, and that's part of this. And I think to the point we talked about earlier is like why he felt that no matter who you were, you needed that vigorous defense. I know he told one of his good friends afterward that, you know, the most successful fighters have grace, and you don't need to be mean-spirited to take people on.
And he certainly embodied that.
You know, quickly before we go to the end, I think the other thing we need to call out is what a leader he was among undocumented immigrants, defending them. He created an entire unit in his office to go and do immigration cases, which is, you know, was the first of its kind. He helped push the city to put millions of dollars into a legal defense fund that is benefiting his attorneys, but also outside lawyers. And really one of the marks that I think he'll leave on the city for a long time.
Well, you know, we don't have the details yet on the remembrance, the service for him. I'm sure there will be one probably at City Hall or maybe somewhere even bigger. But a lot of these people whose lives he touched in one way or another, I'm sure will be there to honor him.
Well, that's going to do it for us, Scott. I know you'll be on tomorrow's forum show talking about him with Matt Gonzalez, who's taken over the public defender's office. But that's going to do it for this special edition of Political Breakdown, a remembrance of Jeff Adachi. I think as many people have said, rest in power, Jeff.
Exactly.
Political Breakdown is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer today is Chris Hoff.
Vinny Tong is our managing editor. Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our chief content officer.
Make sure to subscribe to our Political Breakdown newsletter. You can find our analysis of the week's biggest stories and a sneak peek at the week's Political Breakdown guest.
Exactly. And that will be delivered into your inbox every Tuesday morning. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me at M. Lagos. That's a wrap for this special Political Breakdown from KQED.